Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about this week in Washington in terms of Iraq and al-Qaeda. This week, the draft of the National Intelligence Estimate said that al-Qaeda has made a comeback. The president refuted that. His Homeland Security Secretary said that he had a gut feeling that al-Qaeda was going to attack the United States. The House voted to get out of Iraq by next April. The Senate's vote is coming up. Two important Republican senators, Lugar and Warner, have come up with an alternative plan to the president, and the president, the decider, appears to be in denial about how bad things are in Iraq, given that the United States military just had a shootout with the Iraqi army and police, the very people that they have trained and built up, who apparently, at least according to the people involved in the shootout, were working the Iraqis were in fact an extension of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, al-Quds unit, and of course Maliki basically taunted the United States this week and suggested that he wouldn't lose any sleep if they left Iraq. We'll be talking about this week of turmoil in Iraq with Robert Dreyfuss, who writes extensively on the Middle East, the war on terrorism, and national security for the nation, the American Prospect, Mother Jones, and Rolling Stone. He's a frequent commentator on NPR, MSNBC, and CNBC, and his new book is Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Then we'll go and speak with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, who's a professor of physics at the Qaid al-Azam University in Islamabad. Islamabad, of course, was the capital where the Red Mosque siege ended this week with over 100 people killed. We'll be talking about President Musharraf's declaration of war on the extremists, and apparently the extremists have gotten the jump on him since a number of suicide attackers have killed quite a substantial number of Pakistani troops. And then in terms of the hearts and minds of what makes people tick, particularly the people inside the Red Mosque, we'll be joined by Dr. Kamar al-Huda, who's at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C. He is there, runs a program there on religion and peacemaking. His research focuses on Islamic thought and Islamic philosophy on violence, nonviolence, and conflict resolution. Prior to joining the United States Institute of Peace, Mr. al-Huda was a professor of Islamic studies and comparative religion at Boston College Theology Department. He was also a professor of Islamic studies at College of Holy Cross and Brandeis University. I'm now speaking with Robert Dreyfuss. And Robert, if, as I mentioned, this has been quite a tempestuous week. How much do you think the decider is in denial?
Well, I think he is obsessed with Iraq and seems willing to ignore not only the facts on the ground over there, which are increasingly, dire in terms of the American mission there, but also ignoring the crumbling of the Republican Party and the panic that's starting to set in among Republicans looking ahead to the election next year and wondering how they're going to survive if they have to run for office with this albatross of Iraq hanging around their neck. The problem is that even though everything is looking bad for Bush, I think that, first of all, he can ignore Congress because I don't think they'll get to a veto-proof majority, and the Republicans are not going to vote, I don't believe, to cut off funds for the war. So if he wants to pay the political costs here, mainly the probable destruction of the Republican Party a year from now, he can do that. And second, by killing a lot of Iraqis, he can stay in Iraq for the next 18, 19 months. So he can do a lot of damage, and I think he's determined to do it.
And in terms of the politics of it, given that the Senate is only going to be in session for another 2 weeks before they go on their summer break, and they come back, and by a couple of weeks after they come back, the on September the 15th, the much-awaited report from General Petraeus and Ambassador Croker will be coming in. So I'm just wondering, you know, what's obviously happening here is that when the Democratic senators and congressmen go home and they get screamed at by their base saying, we voted you in to get out of Iraq, you haven't done it. So they're feeling heat. And then on the other side, the Republicans, when they go back to their districts, they get yelled at by their disillusioned supporters who see this sinkhole of money, treasure, and lives going nowhere in Iraq. So just in terms of politics, wouldn't it be wiser for the Democrats to sort of let this thing unravel on Bush's watch? In other words, when Petraeus, who everybody thinks, or the Bush seems to think, is some kind of miracle worker, when he comes back, whatever his report says, I don't think it'll deal with the reality of how bad things are at any rate. So why not let it happen?
Well, I mean, anybody who cares about human life and about the future of Iraq has a moral duty to try to end this war. And I hate to think that the only thing motivating the Democrats is political benefit in an election next year. I mean, they have to do everything they possibly can to bring this war to an end. It may turn out, in fact, that the election next year, you know, cripples, maybe permanently destroys the Republican Party for the next generation. But whether that happens or not, the Democrats really shouldn't be thinking about politics. Now, that aside, let's be real. Clearly, many of them are exactly thinking about that. The problem is that it's difficult, I would say impossible, for the Democrats alone to overturn this Iraq policy. They're not the commander-in-chief. They don't have veto power. And all these people on the left who are blaming the Democrats for not ending the war just don't have a clue about how Congress works. It's impossible if the president is going to veto every bill that comes to him for the Democrats to stop this war from going forward. So in that sense, I guess, yeah, they can sit back and win the political benefits. Now, the other side of the coin is the Iraqis get a vote, too. And the Iraqi politics is moving very fast. The Sunnis are ready to bail out of this Maliki government. So are half of the Shiites. All of the people loyal to Muqtada Sadr. There's an emerging coalition in Iraq which opposes not only the United States but opposes al-Qaeda and opposes the pernicious influence of the Iranian Ayatollahs as well. So all three of that, this nationalist coalition sees as their enemies, the United States, Iran, and al-Qaeda. And that's a good platform for a nationalist Iraqi consensus to emerge. The problem is that the United States is insisting on trying to prop up this ridiculously incompetent Maliki government, which, by the way, is closely allied to Iran. All these Americans who are pointing out all the time that Iran is trying to kill Americans and is sending weapons into Iraq, that's all complete nonsense. The Iranians have direct channels into the highest levels of the Iraqi government. Most of these religious leaders and ayatollahs and other people in Iraq who run the religious parties in Baghdad are, if not Iranian intelligence agents, are on the Iranian payroll or just allied to Iran. The Iran's best allies in Iraq are the people we're supporting.
The Sunni refer to the Shia, Iraqi Shia, as Persians.
That's the derisive term. That's political rhetoric, and it's unfortunate that they would declare the Iraqi Shia to be Persians. That's absurd. The fact, however, is that the political parties, which are ruling by force through armed gangs and militias and death squads are Iranian agents. They are Persians. Half of them actually are from Iran. So the Iraqi Shia population is itself being oppressed by Iranians. And I believe that these religious parties are, you know, losing favor with the Iraqi Arab Shia, who are increasingly supporting people like Muqtada Sadr and the Fadila Party, the so-called Virtue Party, and others. If provincial elections were held, something else that the Iraqi government is blocking, I think you'd see the Sunnis gain tremendously in their areas, and you'd see the Shia voting en masse for Muqtada Sadr and his allies, so that these ruling clowns that we've been supporting in Baghdad would lose power.
And these people who are largely a fiction, the Iraqi government always has been, it's stuck inside the green zone, protected by the U.S. military and by vast walls, they wouldn't last a minute in the real world, but we continue to refer to them as the Iraqi government, and we continue to refer to the largely Shia army and police as the Iraqi army and police. Obviously, al-Maliki's petulant statement, basically telling the Americans that he'd be happy to see them leave. A lot of that, I understand, comes from the fact that they're incensed, these Shiite, Iranian-backed politicians, they're incensed that the United States military are arming the Sunni tribes against al-Qaeda, because they don't care about al-Qaeda, because al-Qaeda obviously hates them as much as they do anybody else. But the long and the short of it is they're thinking about who they're going to be fighting when the full-scale civil war begins.
Well, in part, it's bravado in the sense that the Shiites really, at this point, the leaders at least, depend on the United States for core political support and military aid and other things. If we left, the ones who didn't flee the country would probably end up turning to Iran for support directly. So there's a certain amount of bravado on the part of Maliki saying, oh yeah, sure, go ahead and leave, and our military will handle it on itself. They're not really prepared to do that. And the fact is, the Iraqi armed forces, the military under Saddam, the officers were overwhelmingly Sunni, and the Sunnis know how to fight wars. They're pretty good at it, so they're not going to be pushovers for the Shia if we leave. And that's why I've argued in some of the things I've written that it would not be a Shiite surge that would wipe the Sunnis out if we leave. It would really be a kind of a stalemate, because neither side can afford to go, or has the capability to go, into the other's territory and you know, conquer them or defeat them. So I think it's more likely that you'd see alternate political leadership emerging, and the various sides in Iraq might start to work things out. The Kurds will be kept in check by Turkey. Chances of the Kurds getting an independent state are zero. I think the Kurds know that, although some of them seem still, you know, delusional. So this argument that if we leave Iraq, it'll be chaos and bloodshed and the apocalypse and regional war and genocide, I mean, that argument is being made almost overwhelmingly now by the people who want us to stay in Iraq.
Right, including the president who back in May the 1st of 2003 told us we won the war, mission accomplished, and now he's saying we can't afford to lose the war that he said we had already won. But obviously the president has zero credibility, but nevertheless he is the president.
Well, that argument would make sense, you know, if in fact we couldn't afford to lose the war, but we can.
Right.
It isn't, if we lose the war in Iraq, it isn't like our global position collapses. And I mean, it's just, you know, we leave Iraq and they form their own kind of government. It might be friendly to the United States. It might not. It doesn't really matter. It's not the end of the world, but it's certainly not going to be an al-Qaeda government. It's not going to be a terrorist-supporting
right.
regime.
Al-Qaeda is obviously caught between a rock and a hard place because they've got the Sunni tribes who want to kill them on one side and the Shia who want to kill them on the other.
Well, it's not even al-Qaeda in Iraq. I mean, I'm sure that even most of the people who say they belong to al-Qaeda are still just Iraqi nationalists and Muslim fundamentalists, and they're not taking orders from Osama bin Laden, and all they want is for us to leave their country. I mean, this notion that there's some vast al-Qaeda conspiracy, even among the people who call themselves al-Qaeda in Iraq, is just, it's ridiculous. There's just no evidence at all.
Well, that's the line that the White House is pushing there. It's the ubiquitous Al Qaeda.
He said it this week in his news conference.
But to my mind, though, Robert Dreyfus, is that I think Abizaid and Casey told the president or warned the president of this possibility, but it's not often discussed. And General Bill Odom mentioned it on this program some time back, that he thought that the military were derelict in not planning for the contingency that they could actually be driven out of Iraq, lose their supply lines to Kuwait, and be forced to retreat. And to my mind, this is something that should be thought about because, obviously you can make an argument that the United States military would be so much better off getting out before they ended up getting defeated. Because if the other shoe drops and we go with an all-out war against these Iranian-backed militias on the Shia side, as well as the Sunni insurgents, there's just so few people on the ground there to they'd be overwhelmed.
Yeah, and how are we going to invade Venezuela or Pakistan if we have all our troops in Iraq? That's a big problem for these guys.
Right. But don't you think that somebody ought to start thinking in terms of, isn't it better to pull out before we actually do get defeated?
Well, I think that's already, a big motivating force. When a war is, going so badly, you have to think about the possibility of not just stalemate and a grinding, counterinsurgency, but an actual defeat. And so far that's been staved off by the fact that the majority population in Iraq, namely the Shiites, have not decided to take up arms against the United States the way the Sunnis have. Mm-hmm. If it came to that, our position would be untenable instantly, in part because, as you mentioned, the supply lines through the south are all in, go through Shiite territory, and so we wouldn't be able to get basic elements like food and fuel and ammunition to our troops. Then we'd have to leave, and probably chaotically. That's why the more far-sighted among the establishment are thinking about an orderly withdrawal. Let's start doing it in an orderly way, and in that event, I think most of the Iraqis would be happy not to shoot at us on the way out.
In other words, declare victory and leave.
Well, I guess that's what we would end up doing. They'd try to spin it that we got rid of the dictator and now we can leave. But I sort of like more the admit defeat and leave. I don't like this declare victory notion because, you might as well accept reality. We didn't, when we left Vietnam, we didn't say that we'd won the war. And I think that's pretty much what's going to happen in this case as well. Maybe some neocons will try to spin it that we've declared victory, but we've lost this war. I mean, even the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, says it's lost. So there's no There's no spinning this one anymore.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Robert Dreyfus.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Robert Dreyfus, who writes on the Middle East and the War on Terror and National Security Affairs for The Nation, The American Prospect, Mother Jones, and Rolling Stone. His new book is Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, and his writings appear at robertdreyfus.com. That's Robert D.R. EYFUSS.com. I'm now speaking with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, who's a professor of physics at Qaeda Yassam University in Islamabad, where he's taught for over 34 years. He holds a PhD in nuclear physics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and is the recipient of a number of prizes, and including the UNESCO 2003 Kalinga Prize for the popularization of science. He's a visiting professor at MIT, Carnegie Mellon, the University of Maryland, Stanford Linear Accelerator, and at the moment at Princeton University. And he is a member of the Permanent Monitoring Panel on Terrorism of the World Federation of Scientists. And Dr. Hoodboy, the President Musharraf, after the siege of the Red Mosque was ended in a bloody confrontation where over 100 people were killed, the figures aren't final by any means, but he's essentially went on television and declared war on the extremists, but it looks as though the extremists have gotten the jump on him in terms of a number of suicide bombings that have killed quite a substantial number of Pakistani soldiers.
Yes, and there's been one this morning as well. The situation is bound to get worse. Now there is going to be open war between the Taliban and the Pakistani security forces and the Pakistan army. One could say that this was just going to happen. But this is probably what is going to break the ambivalence that President Musharraf had towards the Taliban. So for years, it had been said that he was hunting with the hounds and running with the hares. But now, after this mosque episode, he has to make up his mind. Which side is he on?
Now, is his largely Punjabi army, are they just institutionally ticked off, to put it mildly, that they'd lost casualties, including a lieutenant colonel in the siege, and now they're losing soldiers in the northwest frontier territories?
Yes, they are losing a lot of people, of soldiers. They're not primarily Punjabi. They're also, those who are fighting in the frontier are people from that area. They are Pathans, and they speak that language. They are from there. And one would have thought that the Taliban would have some degree of accommodation for such people, but no, it's now open warfare. Now, the Pakistan army used to be with the Taliban. In fact, the Taliban were created in seminaries in Pakistan under the watchful eye of the intelligence agencies of Pakistan, which are very closely linked, or rather you should say they are part of the Pakistan army. But after September 11th, when President Musharraf had to choose between the Taliban and being with the Americans, he went with the Americans, and that was the beginning of a dynamic which then steadily led towards this confrontation.
And indeed, in the last suicide bombing in Waziristan, the victims were local Pashtuns who were joining up into the military and the police.
That's right. And this follows very much the pattern that you see in Iraq, that here are people lining up to enlist at a police station, and they are to be recruited, and here comes a suicide bomber and just blows them up. Now, these aren't even people who've actually started working for the police or the security forces or the army. They just want a job, and they're blown up.
So You've laid out, Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, you've laid out a broader canvas here with the ISI helping create the Taliban, and then 9/11, and then apparently the Assistant Secretary of State came over and was rather blunt with Musharraf, saying essentially you're either with us or against us, and there's been some ambivalence on Musharraf's part in terms of really going after both al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Let's deal with them one at a time. What's his ambivalence or apparent ambivalence vis-a-vis really delivering on al-Qaeda, who are clearly there and according to in that territory on the border, and according to the new National Intelligence Estimate, a draft of which was just released or leaked this last week, al-Qaeda is stronger than it was. So it's got gone back to its pre-9/11 strength.
Okay, I'm glad that you distinguish between al-Qaeda and Taliban, but let's take al-Qaeda first. There is no ambivalence in regard that they are the enemy and that they are out to get Musharraf and they are out to get senior members of the army and that they are extremely dangerous and well-armed and so forth. Now, here there is only a question of limitations. How much does the Pakistan army and the intelligence agencies know about al-Qaeda? Do they know enough to, let's say, get their leadership within Pakistan? Well, they're going to try for that. And I think that they have had some success on that. On the other hand, there is sympathy for al-Qaeda within the Pakistan military in the lower ranks, I'm sure, and in the intelligence agencies. Now, the fact that the Lal Masjid issue was able to get as far as it did and that there is possibly involvement of al-Qaeda in that as well, that's an indication of where things are. Now, let's go to the Taliban. There it's different, because there is genuine ambivalence. And Hamid Karzai has repeatedly accused Pakistan of supporting the Taliban while saying that Pakistan is fighting the Taliban. And there is an element of truth in that, because the Taliban have strategically been of importance and are of importance to Pakistan because they provide the means to counter India in Afghanistan. You see, Pakistan has always looked at Afghanistan as being its backyard, so that in the event that India ever attacks and they have to withdraw, they would withdraw into Afghanistan, and that would be like a strategic backyard for them. Now, Pakistan has no allies in Afghanistan other than the Pashtuns and possibly the Taliban. It alienated the Northern Alliance. The government of Afghanistan is hostile to it, and so they see the Taliban as potential enemies and therefore have been ambivalent.
So on our side, given that the United States military are suffering casualties in Afghanistan and NATO is largely bearing the brunt of it, and as you mentioned, Karzai and General Warnock, his defense minister, have gone public on a number of occasions. They provided DVDs, evidence of Pakistan's role. Obviously, there's no love lost between Musharraf and Karzai. But just speaking strategically, if Pakistan is concerned about their western flank being infiltrated by India, and that's why there's this ambivalence and this tacit support for the resurgent Taliban, why don't we show some strategic thinking in the United States? And basically, what is India doing meddling in Afghanistan?
Well, India is a country that wants to extend its power, and it sees Afghanistan as a way of pressuring Pakistan into eliminating the insurgency originating from Pakistan into India at the Kashmir border. There, across the line of control, there had been, since 1987, a steady stream of infiltrators from the Pakistani side going onto the Indian side of Kashmir. And that continued until roughly 2002-2003. Now it's down. The Indians say that it's down too. And one of the major reasons is that Pakistan has this problem on the western border, that is, with Afghanistan. So to the extent that Pakistan has a problem there, it will be less inclined and less able to help militants go from the Pakistani side to the Indian side in Kashmir. That accounts for the pressure, but also that India would like to extend its influence in countries around, and Afghanistan is a market, and it's a place where they can assert their influence. And Pakistan resents that, obviously.
Well, it does seem strange that our soldiers are being killed by the Taliban, and at the same time, General Musharraf is our ally. So, I don't know. At what point does he run out of excuses?
This Lal Masjid episode has, I think, become a turning point. Because now
it's the Red Mosque you're referring to, right?
Yes, yes. The Red Mosque in Islamabad, which, by the way, is just 3 miles away from my university. And we've had the occasion of being threatened by them as well. But that's another issue. After this bloody episode, now that more than 107 people have been killed officially, probably many more, and public opinion is against Musharraf, and militancy has stepped up, and now with these suicide bombings, I think we've reached a turning point, and Musharraf will have to decide, and the Pakistan army, now that it is being targeted, will have to now turn its guns onto the Taliban, because now the peace accord in Waziristan has broken down. It's been now abrogated by the militants who had signed it earlier, and so now it is open war. How far will they go? How far will they be able to fight it? I don't know, because, yes, on the one hand, there is the might of the Pakistan army, but on the other hand, that terrain is so suited for guerrilla warfare and for the kind of warfare which makes even NATO incapable of rooting out the Taliban in Afghanistan. Now the Pakistan army is going to be confronted with that. And remember, this is a different kind of army. This army was actually recruited in earlier times on the slogan of jihad itself. And they saw themselves as being the fighters of Islam, the fighters for Islam. But now they're being targeted by suicide bombers and by jihadists. So there's an immense amount of confusion in the lower ranks. What's it all about?
So would it be possible at all, Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, for the United States and NATO and their special forces are up there on that border on the Afghan side? There's always been friction every time the United States used missiles and in any way crossed into the territories, either with air power or infiltrating special forces. The Pakistan government's always objected, and it's always been very sensitive. Do you see any cooperation now between the Pakistan military fighting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in these territories and the U.S. and NATO on the other side cooperating?
Well, it's going to be tough to say that they're going to allow the U.S. and NATO forces to come into Pakistan's territory. That is a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty, and there's already a lot of anti-U.S. sentiment in Pakistan for right and wrong reasons. There are good reasons, too. Look at the number of civilian casualties that are caused by U.S. bombings. People in the U.S. probably don't get to hear much about that, but there have been large numbers, and human rights organizations have come out documenting this and showing that actually what a lot of the U.S. forces have been saying are just plain lies. So that gets people very, very angry.
You're talking about casualties in Afghanistan from U.S. air power?
Yes. As well as occasional U.S. interventions inside Pakistan. For example, there was a seminary that was bombed and 80 people were killed. Now, whether that seminary actually had fighters, as the U.S. and the Pakistani authorities claim, or whether there were kids in there, we don't know. But the people from that area say that there were also kids in there.
So, well, you know that the Pakistani journalist who went up into those areas, particularly when they tried to blow up Ayman al-Zawahiri and apparently missed him, he revealed the munitions markings on the debris, indicating that it came from the United States, and I believe the ISI disappeared him.
Yes, I don't know how he disappeared. I do know that a lot of journalists have disappeared. That it's not a place where journalists now venture, and so all you get is the official account. Mm. And then human rights groups, they somehow get to survivors or to people who tell them what happened. So the information that's coming out is of dubious quality. So we don't really know. But in Afghanistan, one does have a number of reports, and I do believe they've been reported in the New York Times as well, that there have been a large number of civilian casualties, and that, in fact, the NATO forces have killed more civilians than the Taliban, who also killed civilians very frequently.
But in terms of the anti-Americanism that you mentioned, it's connected to the horror over civilian casualties being, and I guess the Pashtun cross border, which crosses both into Afghanistan and into Pakistan. They probably feel it more intensely, but isn't there throughout Pakistan in general a growing anti-Americanism? And I understand a lot of it's to do with Iraq and what they see on their television in terms of what the United States is doing in Iraq, and particularly in terms of civilian casualties. And also, I understand it's also for the United States is perceived as being the prop that maintains this unpopular military government.
You're absolutely right. Iraq has been a disaster. It was a war that was fought for reasons of weapons of mass destruction turned out to be none. And Saddam Hussein was put across as the reason for 9/11, and it turned out he had nothing to do with it. And so, yes, these reasons are well known the world over. They have had their effect everywhere, including Pakistan. But even there's another reason for the anti-Americanism, because in 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded, Pakistan and the United States and Saudi Arabia, they joined up together to create the Great Global Jihad. And so all the most violent extremist Islamic fighters from around the world were invited here and set up by these three countries. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart, or rather when it started withdrawing from Afghanistan as a consequence of the resistance, then the United States walked away. And it left the Afghanis high and dry. It left these militant fighters in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. And after all, these are the people who then eventually created the situation leading to 9/11. But the U.S. never accepted responsibility for that, and that's been part of the anti-Americanism in Pakistan too, plus all the drugs that came from Afghanistan. So all of these built up to create the present climate.
And in terms of Musharraf's domestic popularity, he was losing popularity rather precipitously, wasn't he? I mean, taking on the Supreme Court was a huge blunder. At times, I understand, when he's appeared on television lately, he's sort of been a little petulant, which, you know, doesn't sort of do his sort of macho image any good. Where does he stand now in terms of having made this declaration of war on the very people that he made an agreement with 10 months ago?
Oh, you're absolutely right. He's done a terrible job politically. First of all, he should never have dismissed the Chief Justice of Pakistan in this way. And even if he had recognized his mistake a week or a month later, he could have saved himself. And then he made a further mistake, and that was, I'd say it's more than just a mistake. It was something absolutely terrible he did. That when the Chief Justice went to Karachi, Musharraf, in collusion with his allies in Karachi, stopped him, and there was a bloodbath in which something like 40 people, more than that, 45 people were killed. And this was all done while televisions in Pakistan were watching and broadcasting it. And so the effect of that was absolutely terrible. Then on the Red Mosque issue, he could have acted much earlier. He could have acted in February, at the time when the militants were abducting people, alleged prostitutes, and blowing up CD shops in Islamabad and so forth. He could have stopped them there, but he didn't, and he allowed them to gather more weapons and ammunition and fuel. And comes along July, they start kidnapping Chinese people in Islamabad, and they start killing soldiers and policemen, and then he has no option left. At that point, it becomes this bloody disaster, and now we're seeing the aftermath of that. So yes, politically, he has shot himself in the foot.
Well, just in closing then, Dr. Mufiz Qutbi, what's the possibility of a restoration of democracy, given the track record of Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif's kleptocratic governments?
Oh, I think that you're absolutely right. They're kleptocrats, they're thieves. Mm-hmm. And we have a choice between thieves and a dictator. But for all that, I think the democratic process must begin. And with time, it will cleanse itself. It will become better. Because once you allow people to start questioning and to be able to decide on the basis of what people say, and once you allow political parties to campaign on the basis of a program, then you create a process that will eventually make itself better. So I'd say that after the next two elections, we'll have a pretty good government, provided that this process is allowed to continue and the military doesn't come in again. So I'm hopeful. I think things will move on.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Dr. Pervez Qutbi.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Pervez Qutbi, a professor of physics at the Qaeda-e-Azam University in Islamabad, Pakistan. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Kamar Al-Huda, who is at the United States Information Institute of Peace, where he's the program officer in the Religion and Peacemaking Program. His research focuses on Islamic thought and Islamic philosophy, on violence, nonviolence, and conflict resolution. Prior to joining the United States Institute for Peace, Dr. Al-Huda was a professor of Islamic studies and comparative religion at Boston College's theology department, and he's also been a visiting professor in Islamic studies at the College of Holy Cross at Brandeis University. And Dr. Al-Huda, what is the you've done a lot of studies on the madrasas, and of course the Red Mosque madrasa was under siege, and finally that it came to a bloody conclusion. What is the, given what Dr. Qutbi is saying, that there's been a backlash against the radicals, and there's apparently quite a bit of support for Musharraf, do you differ in any way from his analysis?
I appreciate one for inviting me to your program, and two, the views of Dr. Qutbi. I think where we differ is the not only the alternatives the government had during negotiation, but also how this disaster is received on the ground from other religious institutions and, of course, non-religious institutions. For instance, if I give you an example, the way that it was handled, and the numbers are high to 225 who may have died inside the mosque, the Red Mosque. Some have claimed that close to 600. We find that the most average citizen of Pakistan found that the degree of force used against the mosque was probably excessive. And there's more and more sympathies for a group of people that are first were called Al-Qaeda, then pro-Taliban, and then they were called all these other names just in the last 10 days. I think there's conflicting messages on what the Ministry of Information is providing and what is provided by the media. And as a result, you have these sort of various opinions that either give sympathies to those who've died in the mosque and perhaps less sympathies to Musharraf, who for the past 6 to 7 months is encountering a lot of resistance from civil society and religious sector.
And is the fact that the government lies fairly regularly, does this lead to a kind of politics of paranoia and conspiracy, since nobody's getting the, you know, if you don't get the truth, then you know, conspiracy thinking tends to fill the void. It's true in this country.
That's true. Conspiracy thinking does dominate in all parts of the world. I think what's counteracting some of the conspiracy is the media that's been very responsible in the past several years. There's been several alternative types of media, print and internet and so forth. So the discussion, politics, and discussion on politics, analysis of politics is very robust in Pakistan. And it's, and receiving information from the official views of the government is not always taken as the Bible, as one would say, or the Quran, very valid. And so you find these other interesting figures, who analysts who come up on television or have columns, and their views are viewed as more authentic and authoritarian.
Now, in terms of the work you've done, Dr. Kamara Al-Huda, examining the madrasas, give us a sense of why the phenomenon exists in the first place. I understand that the public education system has been allowed to deteriorate, and I don't understand, in fact, why United States aid did not go, it's so much of it went to the military, why they didn't divert some of this to making a more solid and secular educational system. But is that the way it is, that the madrasas have sort of filled the void and provided education that the state has failed to do?
There's a yes and no to that answer. First, I'll start with a very quick response, that the madrasas existed for about 1,100 years in all parts of the Muslim world, and it traditionally offered both religious and non-religious, the sciences, the non-sciences. And by the formation of Pakistan, you had the madrasas just being the sole place for seminary and religious education. The public education was seen as an avenue to excel in sciences, law, and finance, and so forth. And what happened is you have two worlds of education, one in the religious world, where they have very little understanding or very little exposure to the non-religious sciences or to humanities, and then you have in the public education sector, people focus and become very specialized in finance or the particular field and have very little understanding of the religion or religious sciences. And as a product, you have a society who is polarized in their educational formation and in their critical thinking. I wouldn't say, and I wouldn't agree in that point, that the religious education has picked up where the government has failed. I would say the religious education institutions have been so part of the fabric, and in all parts of South Asia, and particularly in Pakistan, where the government can't or hasn't provided schools and education in rural Pakistan or in the north or in southwest, the madrasas have provided schools, free education, free lodging, free an alternative education to kids that perhaps would not have any alternative to life.
But where do they get the money to do this?
Oh, it's historically just local charities, donations from the local community. Businessmen or businesswomen. It's and some institutions are very global, so they receive money from international institutions. But the local rural madrasa in southwest Pakistan or northwest Pakistan, they receive it from their local business folks.
So what about the Saudi Wahhabis? Do they have much influence?
They only have influence with a particular sect of Sunni Islam. The Sunni Islam in Pakistan has four sects, at least four sects, and one of them, Ahl Hadith, is very pro-Wahhabi, but their numbers are very small. the percentage of students that go to Wahhabi or Ahl-Hadith madrasas are very tiny, and they don't have much influence in the wider spectrum of religious beliefs, and I think in Pakistan.
But Pakistan is the only other place where Sunni-Shia religious violence has taken place outside of, obviously, the enormous bloodletting that's going on in Iraq. Can you give us some idea of the percentage of Shiism in Pakistan, in Islam in Pakistan, and what the nature of the conflict is?
Sure. The percentage may be between 10 to 12% of the population may be Shia, and that's a particular mainstream Shia form called the 12 or Shia. There are other types of Shias also that exist. And I think the degree of sectarian violence that has occurred is sort of a manifestation from the Afghan war, from also the Iranian revolution. All of these have had spillovers into the very basic foundations of Pakistani society, some causing fears on the Sunni side, some causing fears on the Shia side. And as a result, by the late 80s, 88, 89, we find that there were militias of both on the Sunni side and of the Shia side in Pakistan, both who were well-armed, well-funded by outside sources to eliminate the other, destroy their clerics, to destroy their institutions. And so in the last 4 or 5 years, the numbers I've seen is sometimes, due to sectarian violence, we've seen numbers as 600 to 650 people dead.
Well, Dr. Kamal al-Huda, just in the context then of this week's statement after the mosque was taken back, and the official count is 117 dead. You're saying it could be as high as 600.
That's right.
Which is appalling, and I imagine a lot of those casualties would be women and children. The president goes on television and essentially declares war on the religious extremists. They, in turn, seem to get the jump on him. A number of suicide bombers, particularly in the Waziristan, have. But what was interesting about it, and I mentioned this earlier with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, is that it's very much a mirror of what happens in Iraq, where the people who are desperate for work and are poor show up to join the police or the military, and they get blown up. So the fact that people are so poor seems to be a big factor in it. And would it be possible if Musharraf could divert some funds? Another thing that I thought was interesting was that the army over there in the territories is not necessarily the Punjabi army that we've been led to believe, but they recruit local Pathans. So what's the possibility then of the military actually containing this situation?
I also have the point of view that the Pakistani army has been pretty extensively involved with the war on terror since 9/11. I don't hold a view that they've held back. Every indication shows that they've been very aggressive. They have, out of any other country that allies with the United States, they have produced more criminals and more terrorist suspects than anyone else. Their army has suffered more casualties and deaths than any other country, especially on the Afghan-Pakistani border. At the moment, the border has about 85,000 to 90,000 Pakistani troops. And when you travel in Pakistan, you see Pakistani troops and commandos very visible, especially in hot spots. So I hold the view that they are being quite extended and may be stretched too far, so that could be an issue. When the President Musharraf comes on TV to say that he is now 150% committed to eliminating radicals from Pakistani society, he's saying clearly that the policy is not a soft policy, it's not a casual policy, and he had to return a public statement that Al-Qaeda had made a statement just 3 days earlier on videos and so forth and faxes. So in a sense, he is coming out and saying this is not going to be tolerated, and no religious institutions, no civilian institutions, is going to go further without scrutiny. So I think the government, in a way, has done a great deal of militarizing the society, and it could do a better job by non-military alternatives to combating terrorism, which means, to me, including a greater civil society involvement in anti-terror strategies, bringing in teachers and scholars from these madrasas, and to make sure they fully understand the policy and act in ways in their institutions that's responsible, civically responsible. So I think there's a number of things they could do that's not this, a direct example of militarizing, using a military policy.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Al-Huda, you get the impression that the autonomous Northwest Frontier in Waziristan, that they're sort of the Wild West, as though that's sort of irredeemable. And I'm hearing through the cracks here that it's just a case of poverty and lack of government services. And if they improved the lot of these people, a lot of this radicalism would go away.
I think those particular factors are definitely important. I think politics is important. The history of the region, of these tribes, and their insecurity with governments making deals, or feeling they've been exploited by either a government policy or international foreign policy. Poverty and social conditions is definitely the top three reasons why terrorists are cultivated. But I think they also have their own sense of history and a sense of what is being exploited to them themselves. They also, in this area, the Fatah area, federally administered tribal areas, they don't have a particular status in Pakistan. Representation and civil rights and so forth. So I think there's a great deal of political issues, political representation issues that stand. So I think it's a little complex based on history, too.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us and for filling us in on what is not just so much going on militarily there, but also socially in terms of the hearts and minds, as we often say over here.
Yeah.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Dr. Kamal Al-Huda, who is the program officer in the Religion and Peacemaking Program at the United States Institute for Peace in Washington, D.C. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, associate producer, Rusty Nguyen, assistant producer, Lick Doan, and Tamika Zoghi, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org.